Hey, I'm Cole Cornford, and you're listening to Secured. Each episode, I bring on developers, security leaders, and innovators to discuss the reality of AppSec. We cover the wins, the slip-ups, and the stories that make this industry a little more interesting. Stick around, and you'll enjoy this one. Today, I'm joined by Pedram Hayati, founder of Sectum and SecTalks. He's an industry legend who's been building a secure code training platform with an emphasis on using sharp feedback cycles and iterative Git commits as a way to reinforce those concepts. We have a great chat about nitty-gritty concepts. So techies and code reviewers, this is an episode for you. Pedram is switched on. If you enjoyed this episode, you should absolutely trial Sectum and see what he's been building. I'm sure he would love to hear your feedback, and personally, so would I. So, Pedram, did you want to give everyone a bit of an outline about what Sectum is? Because, like, I've known about the product for quite a long time, and I was always a bit confused about the name as well. Like, I think it's Security Dimension, but it's just always confused me. So,
it was just looking for a short abbreviation to register a domain name, because who will type in Security Dimension, right? So, Sectum, clear and short. So where this idea came from? The idea was been there for quite a while. So even before Sectum, when I was involved with the founding members of LTAM and being one of the founders there, we were always thinking about, I actually can go back even like when I was doing pen testing for BAE system, it was always wanted this, seeing that our pen test reports are being used by the people, or especially the engineers. And probably you know as well, you go year after year, you provide findings, and that it's hard to move the needle. Like, you will see the same repeat findings coming ahead or coming up. So what happened was, there was always a question, what is happening? Is it because of we don't write a good pen test report, or is it because we don't communicate well, or is it because there's a lack of awareness on dev side? So obviously we started with some usual secure training workshops for devs, and that goes back to 8 to 9 years. And in every single secure coding workshop that we have been running, that is through BAE and then later LTAM and other ones, there was always this part where you're like, I want just a hands-on component. And you were kind of very tempted to use CTF, and I tried a lot of them. But by the end of the day, you will realize, no, CTFs is not really something for devs. It's engaging, it's interesting. It can show them, wow, how XSS or, I don't know, CSERF works. But would that really result into they understand the good patch or the best practice? That was always lacking. And if you look at the industry, or just open source or industry, a lot of things focus a lot on the offensive side of the thing, you know, exploitation, hacking is all about do this. And then when it comes to the recommendation, it suddenly is everything like very generic or boilerplate code or code snippets that they want to show an example of a security patch, but there is no one in the universe who will write the patch in that way in a production or enterprise code. So I find the problem is both sides, that we don't know the industry engineering world, and at the same time, the engineers, they don't know our world. So the whole idea of the Sectum was to sort of bridge that gap, but in a cool and a fun and more natural way, rather than, hey, this is a mandatory training that you have to do, and if you don't do it, your KPI is going to go down, or your manager is going to be angry at you.
What do you mean? I don't open the training video and just skip to the end, and then I've got compliance, right? It's all good.
That's it, right?
The CTFs is interesting for me, because we do secure code training like quite a lot, and we recently lost a reasonable scale deal to a bigger business than my small little bird one, because we lacked a CTF. And
okay,
I remember saying back to the person who was buying the products, like when they were interviewing us, I said, CTFs are not how you train developers. It's ineffective. And so it's good to hear that my viewpoint is validated by you, even though
exactly,
I lost the deal.
Cool, yeah. That was exactly that point. I mean, and I saw it through actually running it many times for enterprises, for private setups, and there was all this excitement and engagement, and people, they think that the learning happened, but in reality it didn't. So the whole idea of the Sectim was like, I always believed in CTF, even in the university courses that I teach over the years. I always encourage people to do CTFs, to learn security. This was like one of the many ways to show your hands-on skill. I was just like, but can we have some sort of a CTF idea, but in the dev environment or in a dev or engineering setting, or like a CTF friendly for devs? And the whole idea of came around that, what if instead of capture the flag, we have fixed the flag? So the idea is that, okay, you go and find and detect, but you only get a score when you're fixing it. So we played around with this idea for a while. We had some proof of concept. We ran it in some trainings, like MVP, as they call it back in the days, using like Git repository. Because the another thing was, in order to learn something, you should not learn a platform just to start learn something new. Like some of the trainings that I also see is that it just to understand, just to start your learning journey, you need to first learn how to operate this platform or how to work with this person, where to click, where not to click. That itself for me is like, why are we doing it? Like, what if we, instead of we invite developers to come to us, we go to them and offer the content in the language, in the methodology, in a way that they are familiar with them.
I think that's a really good one, because the user experience of having to move people out into a different ecosystem and then bring them back into there, that context switching is killer. And I've seen it a lot with just traditional AppSec products. Like more recently, AI's changed it a bit so that in your IDE, you can get feedback constantly while you're doing stuff, like that's written in natural language. But like maybe 4 to 5 years ago, we had a proliferation of ecosystem-based security products where you'd say you have GitLab and the security runners are just built directly into the pipelines. And so developers who are doing coding in GitLab get security findings there. But then like, I think another 5 years prior to that, and you'd have like a product like Checkmarks or Fortify, and the developers would scan the code that would get shipped off to an ecosystem over here. And it's completely irrelevant and unrelated, not on their workflow. And so like oftentimes people wouldn't even go over there to go look at the results. No. It just wouldn't happen. And I can see it's exactly the same for having to train people, because if you're asking them to have to first learn how to use the training environment before they actually get any value out of it, they're probably going to stop.
And exactly. And 100%. I think in security, it's kind of, we have this tendency that we create, as you said, our own ecosystem. And I'm glad it's changing over the time. You mentioned about CI/CD and the whole concept of DevSecOps. I was checking the other day, the concept of DevOps, it was actually coined in the year 2001. So, well, and when we had started adopting it in security, maybe 5-6 years ago. So we are a little bit lacking. And this is a part. Developers are pretty picky. They want a smooth experience. They want, and sometimes because, you know, the way that they're looking at any technology or platform, aside from what content they consume, is like, how these guys have built this? Is it using like some old school, like weird code snippets or environments that nobody even do it these days? And that kind of completely put them off. So they're very picky in terms of how you should communicate to them.
Yeah, I mean, like I see it a lot when, because like, I've seen a lot of pen testing firms, like not Eltham, by the way. Eltham did good. I remember doing my secure programming in Java course back in 2018. Yeah. So, you know, big thumbs up there. But like other testing firms, like large ones, and what they do is often go OWASP top 10 and then go through every single vulnerability class showing you how to hack. And then the examples they use are always either contrived or they use something like WebGoat. And I'm like, you cannot take WebGoat or Juice Shop seriously as a developer, because you look at it and you think it's a joke. Like, you understand it's for a training ecosystem, but like, are people actually writing like Java Spring applications as much anymore? And especially not with the kind of interface that's there. It's very Web 2.0 at this point. It's one of the things I thought very heavily about when, like, because in my company, I've got a product called Birdhouse that we use for our training. And, it's a, you know, Dockerized Node.js application, React. And I one of the things I thought was really important for developers is to see not contrived examples, like every single field has cross-site scripting, because that's not going to happen anymore. Like people use React, but I've put into the app situations where you'd say, okay, we have a field where we want to give people the ability, kind of like MySpace back in the day, to just run some HTML for styling on the About Me page. And like, let's let them use, we'll block script tags, they'll be fine, you know? And it's a naive, it's something that the developer thinks they're doing the right thing, but we know that there's ways around it. And so, like, I wanted to show situations where you're satisfying a business requirement with a security one, and in a language and framework that's like reasonably modern. It sounds like you've been doing that with SecTeam as well.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. As I mentioned, they are quite picky. So I think I would kind of say in three angles where, and if you want to deal with devs, you should be always focused. First of all, use the latest and greatest tech that is out there that devs are using it. Mm. Like aside from, so SecTeam, whatever content is delivered in SecTeam is based on Git. So we have this developer first Git based experience. In fact, they can even clone the whole content and lab locally. You don't want to limit them. They can use their own IDE. They can use their own, these days, agentic AI to go through it. Because that's the experience a dev would like to have. And if you look at any dev, modern dev tooling these days, they don't limit them. They let them to extend it, to expand it. In fact, very recently, we also introduced our own AI MCP, which creates a customized hyper-tailored learning path based on the vulnerability that's identified in your code or based on your GitHub profile. So it gives you like, hey, I know that you've been working on files or databases. Probably you want to know about this and this and that. You want to do this lab in past traversal. You want to know this about log injection because I've seen you log into the files. So something very specific to them. And they like those things. Now, they're just getting it immediately within their, as you said, in their IDE that, you know, someone wants to get additional resources, especially today is important because AI is now fixing things without they understand what the fix is about. So we're providing and supporting them with additional resources that devs, they kind of continue on their learning journey. That's very, very key. I mean, the other thing is, as you mentioned, the examples or content you want to take them through need to resemble something in reality, because that is another thing devs are picky about. Like, and if you think about it, a lot of security vulnerability titles, and I complain about this all the time, have a terrible name, have a horrible name. Like if you just pick any of them, let's just take the most obvious one, cross-site scripting.
I hate it. I say content injection. I like content injection, but then everyone's like, what is this? I'm like, well, it could be
what is this?
JavaScript. It could be like, because they've heard of XSS, but I think it's a lot clearer when you say content injection, but no one's caught on that apparently. So XSS is here. So
no, it's just, what do you mean by cross? What is site? I mean, we don't have any concept of sites anymore, or like server side template injection. Like, and you kind of, we abbreviate it to SSTI. These are, from engineering perspective, they're like, what this guy is talking about? But if you drill down, there are some terminologies in engineering world that is equivalent of this insecure behavior that we can use. So these are, and another thing is real world incident. Almost every content we have is attach an insecure concept to a reality of this thing happened to a company or it happened in a CVE. And this will go far away. I remember developers, they come to me and they say, hey, I think in this code, I have that issue, that GitHub hack issue. I'm like, what are you talking about, GitHub hack issue? And I remember he's referring to an incident that he did in one of the labs, which was attached to a GitHub mass assignment issue that happened in mid-2011, that someone was able to add his own public key to every single Git repository out there. So it was a mass assignment. Like even the web, so he didn't remember what mass assignment is, as we call it, but he remembered the GitHub hack, which I think for us to teach something to someone, this is the key. I don't care what, if he remembers the title, but if he remembers that insecure pattern, and when he writes the, or she writes the code, he remembers, okay, I should watch out for this.
Yeah, I like using examples a lot as well. I either pick known incidents, or I pick like assurance activities. So like, because we have this AppSec as a service thing where we do all sorts of different things, get AppSec out of the box. And part of it is just regularly refreshing secure coding training stuff for people. And the way that we then tend to do that is to take like, say, pen test or code review results. And then those can inform what we're going to reinforce some kind of concept so they can see what's related to in their code base. And then also cross that with like some kind of incident that we've seen in the past. And like the one that always comes up and I love using all the time is, and again, stupid name, is the OMI God Azure, which is like the Azure Management Plane or something, Orchestration Management Interface. And the reason I like that one is it covers a variety of bug classes that are like people in and of themselves, they're like, oh, I don't see what the issue is, which is constructors providing default values and not being considerate of what the default value is.
Uh-huh.
And another one is to do with not front loading, with defensive programming, you want to have guard conditions. So you want, if you make a mistake, you want to exit your programs like gracefully at the beginning before going down into execution. And what they did is they had all of the validation steps occurring intermingled into the logic of the program rather than upfront. And so I say to people, well, if you have sensible constructors, it makes sense, which in this case, the constructor defaulted to zero, which was for a number is to UID is zero, as you can figure out what happened there.
No, exactly.
So I like those kind of examples. And also pointing it to like an assurance, like we did a pen test and we found this kind of thing. And that this would have been solved if you had authentication authorization checks at the top of every single function call, right? So then they can see how realistic it is and how they're making those mistakes. So I think that's really good that you're using those examples and pointing to it because, the Optus hack, mate. How did the Optus hack happen? Oh, because no one did any authentication authorization checks on the front end, So,
and they relate to it, right? By the end of the day, we are humans, and the more analogy we have, the more keywords that we have, we keep people more engaged and make that thing more memorable. Is another side of the thing. And the other thing, I think we are not doing it well in a security industry, and I don't think we are well positioned to do it, is to come up with design patterns or secure design patterns, right? Almost every security guy is talking about, defense in depth, least privileges. I don't know. I'm like, these are so vague and high level. They are great, but you need to talk about specifics. You need to talk about what design pattern they can follow, or go and check. There are actually super amazing design patterns within engineering industry that they know it. Probably if you emphasize that this design pattern is good, it can also help them with the security. Like the example you mentioned, that the whole idea of the constructors and putting value, we have a concept in engineering called value objects. If you tell it to the engineer, they will know what is it. Right. And so just say, hey, if you do value object, your objects, your domain models are safe. Okay. That's it. Like they know what to do. You don't need to talk about validation, where to put the validation, where to enforce it. Value object is a pattern that they know they can follow. I think for us in a security industry, we should make ourselves more familiar with these sort of things that happen. There also, I feel, a taxonomy, how to map the concept and concerns we have from a security industry to the engineering industry, and that kind of helps them to kind of bridge more and more in gap.
Maybe that's something I should look at creating, is like some kind of reference architecture for secure coding patterns or something, right? Because I see these things all the time, like things like not having default cases in like if everything falls over, having a way to escape something, or not front loading exit conditions, or doing string concatenation instead of interpolation. There's like these kind of things I keep seeing. Short circuiting of conditionals is another one. There's a lot of things but then there's a bunch of esoteric rules that you need to remember. And when is the right rule, the one that we bring into the situation? And then that usually gets thrown out and people forget about that. So I think there's value in AppSec people learning those kind of things, but where I see there being true values with when these kind of concepts are put into some popular kind of framework or library that people consume and use, and then there's abstraction and people don't need to be thinking about it anymore. Because I take React's probably the most well-known one, but even before React, just like Ruby on Rails and just MVC style architectures. The fact is, if you use Rails, there's a good chance that you're eradicating a bunch of bug classes by default.
Automatically, right?
So, because you'll have active records, which at the time SQL injection was a big thing. Everyone would try SQL payloads. Yeah, we've got active record payloads, but whatever. there's the ERB. So that's output encoding that people don't need to be thinking about. Every route has an auth and an authorization check applied to it. But people that haven't adopted Ruby at the same scale as, say, you know, Spring or Express or Django and so on. And so it's, I think that if we get people to be picking up and building in secure defaults into these technologies, then that's how we get like wide range, like improvements. So
no, exactly. Like everyone talks about secure by design, right? But I always say secure by default is even better. But to reach there, I think there need to be a marriage between the engineering guys and the security guys, because there are things we know, but there are a lot of things we don't know, like how the React is the great example of it. Like, I think if you look at the whole history of cross-site scripting, which was originally coined by a Microsoft engineer, and all the effort the security guys, they did HTML purify, there were DOM purifier, there was all these ideas we had, okay, this is how we should do fix the cross-site scripting, and almost none of them being adopted by engineering guys because they're like, what is this library?
Like I fundamentally hate content security policy. Because I have seen engineering teams waste weeks, months, if not years on having to maintain a dynamic nonce generated thing that changed because everything. And they say, what's the point of this? And then someone in security will say defense in depth. Defense, and I'll just say, sounds like you're just adding lots and lots of overhead to your engineering function, right? And like browsers nowadays have like features like trusted types and stuff built in, which you can add into your CSP. I don't think I've seen a single company even adopt that. But what, you know what I have seen? Lots of people choose to use Angular. Lots of people choose to use Laravel. Lots of people use React. So like, use those. They're more secure. Don't fuck around with content security policy.
100%. So. Exactly. Because it works. It's not just about security, right? So where I was going with that is when we have something like React. Like the Angular came earlier than React in terms of those. That's the concept of Angular sandbox, which was purely built to stop cross-site scripting. They pushed it up until 2006 and they found out, oh, this is not going to extend because everybody was talking about now Angular sandbox bypass. Eventually it got fixed, but there was a lot of lesson learned that how we need to design a front-end library to, by default, that's a key, by default is secure against any of these content injection type attacks. Unless you really shoot yourself in the foot. You know, in React is beautiful because if you really want to render HTML raw, there is a function called dangerous inner HTML. Like, that naming is beautiful. And again, React was not the first library doing it. Those guys, they adopted those lessons learned from, there was other programming language back in the days that they had. Like, if you wanted to call something which is potentially result in a security issue, they should have such an obvious name that it shouldn't call eval. Like, eval is terrible. It should be called dangerous, the most dangerous function you can call, like, and then give it the input. So,
and like, a lot of these things only came about because engineers moved forward with how they were doing things. Because I think back in those days, the vogue was still, let's use like Bootstrap and some kind of like front end library like jQuery to design stuff. And people, I think it was called SSCS or SSVS, where you started to compile JavaScript server-side and then turn that HTML into what you sent to the, rather than having to directly modify the DOM in the browser. So that's why React started to do well. But I think it was, the other thing is that there was a bandwidth was expensive for social media networks at that point. And so, like, having to go and do AJAX requests back and forth constantly, I think that pattern started to fall over and people wanted to say, well, I want to make it look like we're still doing that, which is how we ended up with like React to solve a network and performance challenge. Mm-hmm. That, and then they said, well, can't we use this to also do security?
Security.
So yeah. I like when we can take an existing concept, like, like there's this framework people have been using for a while called 12-factor. Where they say a 12-factor app is quite resilient for all of these different reasons. Mm-hmm. And like, one of those that I like is just build reproducibility.
Mm-hmm.
Such a simple concept that I can just push a button and then start to finish that my software application can be built, you know? Many places have manual steps, or they require checklists, or there's some change control process or whatever, but they can't reproduce builds from scratch every single time. But then you get engineers to start doing that. You can have a conversation about, if you have reproducible builds and you have an outage, you can then recover really quickly. Or if you can release software a lot faster because it's quicker to, deploy in a production environment.
Mm-hmm.
And then the security person like me says, but the byproduct is that if you have a security incident, you can recover very quickly. If you have a security, you need to patch really fast. You can, so it's like as a byproduct of doing good engineering, you get security.
Exactly.
As well. So I'm all of that kind of stuff. And I wish I could spend more time just reading my software engineering books and stuff, but instead I have to drink water with my flaming galah glass. So
you will be surprised. There are just so many amazing coding patterns and design patterns and concepts within software engineering industry that it helps us in security to communicate in the right language to devs. And we do not need to reinvent the wheel. Like, this is like the concept of immutability. I mean, that is similar to what you just described. This has been in the engineering industry since, I don't know, 80s. Because they knew that if you build something mutable, if something changes at the runtime, you're probably going to have some bugs. So they were always advocating that build in the same way, write a program in a way that you don't have a concept of variable, everything is immutable. And then the whole concept of immutable infrastructure came around, which nowadays become like a stock standard within Kubernetes and in cloud infrastructures, which you can think about it. Actually, immutability goes hand in hand with security, because it is what it is. And if it is, something happen, we can, as you said, reproduce the whole infrastructure and just push it and refresh it and done. And it's just for us to kind of expand on those. For a while, I was looking at different language communities, like comparing like what the JavaScript guy is talking about for the next version of JavaScript, the compiler, the ES. And then what the Rust guys are now talking about, what the Go guys are talking. You could clearly see which language industry is focused on what. Like, one of the things in terms of like JavaScript, you could see, actually Python was a good example of it. There was a big discussion around, if you have a switch statement in your code, should this switch statement has a default case by default, or should we keep it open? Because languages like, for example, Rust, this is a non-negotiable. You must have a default case. It goes back to that the thing you talked about, constructor having default values.
Yep.
Like you build some switch in Rust, cause different thing, but it has a default case that you know if none of these things cases happen, that default case will kick in. But in languages like Python and JavaScript, is up to you, and that is up to you can result into an undecided state and a security issue.
What is this? Like the concept, I think it's called orthogonality, which is where you have many ways to achieve the same outcome. And I'm seeing that more languages are being restrictive and trying to get people down to a preferred or a correct way to do something, as opposed to having a lot of ways of doing something.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Like to give people an example, that's a bit easier. If you want to combine two numbers, you may go I plus one, you may go I plus plus, you may go I dot add one. Yeah. I equals I plus one.
Yeah.
And so you can see that there's like four or five different ways, and there's quite a lot of nuances that are different between how these calculations are being performed. But you don't really know like what that's going to be unless you really go behind the scenes into the weeds. And so like two languages I know reasonably well, Golang and PHP. Mm-hmm. Not that I ever get to see any Golang, which makes me sad because I spent so long. Oh, it's a beautiful language. I just don't come across it all that much. But every time I do get to see my series of people with nil, error statements over and over again, I'm like, guys, this is not how you're supposed to do the program. Whatever. Let them learn. They're just junior engineers. They haven't figured out the concept of errors of variables, right? So that's all right. But Go is very opinionated about making sure that you do the right thing every single time. And they don't have the concept of a while loop, for example, because they say that, for, you can just say for forever, right? Like there's no while. So, but the other languages, they'll have a for loop, a for each, and a while. And then suddenly there's like slight nuances between each of these. So I like when they reduce orthogonality. And yeah, security people, like you're reading all of these like forums and documents to try to work out what's happening in the future. Most security people I've spoken to, I'll say, hey, PHP, what do you think? And they'll be like, huh, PHP, that's the worst. You know, there's like so many vulnerabilities and it's like horrific. And I'm just like, how long has it been since you've actually written PHP? Because they've like basically backported all of the nice things across all of the other languages into PHP 8. So if you're, you know, still thinking that PHP 5 is, you know, the bee's knees, I think that your knowledge set's a little bit out of date, right? So
no, personally, yeah. I mean, a lot of attacks, what I remember, register global. I mean, there's still some people, they think that is enabled by default. That was like really horrible because you could effectively mass assignment everything in PHP, but it has come a long way. In fact, the default encryption algorithm in PHP for passwords is actually top notch comparing to the, so like for example in Python it's still bcrypt you're using it, but in PHP they moved on to more recent one
to like already. The cha stuff. I don't know. The guy, oh, if Scott Contini was here, he'd tell me about all the crypto things because he's smart like that. But like I just read things and see if it says des and then cry. So you know.
But in terms of like adoption, what we will see at least still like sadly JavaScript is the top one, following with Python these days, especially with the hype around ML and AI. There's a lot of those easy to use frameworks, as you say, are in Python and JavaScript. So TypeScript kind of just finding its way into Ruby is a surprise to see something. This is just on a security side of things, what we actually see, because we run these contests and competitions. We offer people like different vulnerabilities in the different languages. And JavaScript, Python, like you need, everyone gets it. Maybe following with Go, which is good. And Java, if, you know, enterprise settings, yeah, C sharp. But PHP, not that many.
Maybe I've just got in a weird spot where I've just had a bunch of PHP customers. Like a while. I'm like, why is everyone writing in Symfony and Laravel? Like, what is going on? It's like, it's better than them coming to me and saying, hey, Cole, like, do you like Kix terminals and COBOL and like some Perl scripts to wrap it all together? And I'd be like, ooh, guys, like, let's talk about the paragraphs and sentences, you know? So,
yeah.
So I guess like, if people wanted to get a bit better at learning about this kind of stuff, other than just going and registering for an account SecDim, like where would you start?
In terms of secure coding, secure code learning, or
let's go a bit beyond that, because most of the people who listen to this podcast are application security professionals, right? So they're already aware of concepts like input validation, output encoding, and so on and so forth, but they may not quite understand reference architectures, design patterns, orthogonality, memoization, like all of these software engineering things. Like what would you do, or where would you suggest people go to build up that kind of skill base? Because I know lots of AppSec people right now are so oriented towards product that products define what their knowledge base is, which is usually vulnerability classes rather than good architecture patterns for secure coding principles. Yeah. So.
Look, I always, and this was even my number one recommendation to our pen testing back in the days, I was always saying, go and learn how you can build one app from scratch all the way to staging, to the dev, to the prod. Go through all the steps. Because that is like number one skill that I see is lacking within the people who mostly be the offensive security roles. They probably can come up with amazing idea, these edge cases, to identify an edge case that result into a vulnerability, but they don't really understand the inner working of today's cloud native app or today's application that are being deployed. Once you go through all this stage to understand how devs today, when you can pick any language, I mean, I would suggest start with the JavaScript and Python and start from, start talking about building one app. Building on API, expose some things. Maybe these days use some of the offer some agentic interfaces there. But go take it all the way and learn, for example, how this thing need to be configured in a CI/CD. So you need to learn now, I don't know, if you are in GitHub Actions, and learn, okay, now how you need to pass the secret to this CI/CD. Learn it, see it, not just don't conceptualize this thing. Okay, yeah, I know how CI/CD works. It's very different from the time you actually start writing that GitHub workflow. And then learn Kubernetes or learn some of these CloudFormation scripts or Terraform. These are the tools devs are working with. What you're going to get at the end of this is you suddenly going to be exposed to a different territory of whole different bug classes, whole different vulnerabilities that nobody even know that happened. Starting from that in the IDE, and then you were thinking, what if, because you have this hacker mindset, right? What if this one of these plugins extension or these days, these MCP things that I have may be malicious? So the code that I'm writing from now on is already flawed. And then you were thinking about, CI/CD, there are just so many rooms for some malicious activity to happen. Kubernetes is whole another story. I think myself, I learned a lot by just going and learning how engineers there do their thing and actually doing it. And it replicated across different languages. You know, you mentioned Go and see how Go, for example, in some cases, by default, cater for some situations, but the same code, the same language, the same framework, you take it to JavaScript, doesn't happen. And there you go. So you got a vulnerability identified straight away just because, you know, Go does it, but JavaScript doesn't do it. A lot of these, they don't even have a name. Like, we don't really have a title for them. So I would say, and there are amazing materials out there to understand this. And it helps you to, I feel every pentester or need to understand code. I feel today, if you don't understand code, you're very limited to the things you can find.
Well, don't worry. I'm sure that every pentester is just going to say, AI is going to write my code for me. So what do I need to know, right? It'll be fine.
All right. Let's leave it there.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure. Do you have any parting words, or would you like to just do a quick pitch about SecDeem to the audience?
Well, no, thanks for having me. Obviously, if you are passionate about AppSec, DevSecOps, secure coding, obviously SecDeem offers an environment. We are actually open to open source community. We do offer them a free access. Also, we have quite large number of community challenges that people they can use, and they can even contribute challenges there. And I would say the best way to learn is by doing it rather than reading.
All right. Well, thank you so much, everyone. Go check out SecDeem, and I'll see you next time. Thanks a lot for listening to this episode of Secured. If you got any feedback at all, feel free to hit us up and let us know. If you'd like to learn more about how Galah Cyber can help keep your business secured, go to galahcyber.com.au. If you're new to the show or a seasoned veteran, I want to hear from you. I'm always looking to do better as a podcast host and as a person. So tell me about what I can do better. Tell me about the types of people you want on my podcast. Tell me about if the format's working for you or styles need to be switched up. Do I need to interview differently? So on and so forth. I appreciate you sticking with me for almost 30 episodes at this stage, and I hope I can keep learning and you can keep learning and being entertained for many more episodes to come. So please shoot me feedback. I want the good, the bad, and the ugly to pod@galahcyber.com.au. And if you don't like email, hit me up on LinkedIn. Quick update. I'm launching a new course for 2025. It's Foundations of Application Security. It's a 2-day bootcamp covering everything you need to become a well-rounded AppSec practitioner. There's both public and private courses available, and the best part about it all is taught by me. So if you're interested, just send me an email, call@galahcyber.com.au, or say hi on LinkedIn if you can have a chat about it.